Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on our show, we'll be hearing about how Jewish communities across West Virginia are struggling to keep their traditions alive.
It is actually kind of scary. Like, I worry because a lot of people my age are moving away for, like, school or, you know, jobs.
From ceremonies in a synagogue to the ingredients of Jewish cuisine, religious traditions are intertwined in culture. We'll stop by the Temple Israel in Charleston to break bread for a traditional meal.
Briskets, which is a form of Friday night beef that we grew up with.
And this is my daughter, Nora. She's one. She's getting her first bite of matzo ball soup.
And we'll hear from two West Virginians who survived the Holocaust.
I worked my feet off after the war, and I was sure my dad was going to be on that list. And then finally you realize he wasn't coming back.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia.
Banu choshech legaresh Beyadenu or vaesh Kol echad hu or katan Vichulanu or etan Sura choshech halashcho Sura mipnea or Sura choshech halashcho.
The Jewish holiday of Hanukkah began December 6th and continues through December 14th at sundown. And that song we just heard was a traditional Hanukkah song sung by Josh Barrett. Josh Barrett teaches Jewish songs to the local Sunday school at B'nai Jacob Synagogue in Charleston, West Virginia. Hanukkah honors the struggle of ancient Jews to restore the Temple of Jerusalem. A small amount of oil lasted for 8 days, and the Jews believed it was a miracle. It's not one of the high holy holidays for Jews, but still remembered by lighting a candle and exchanging a gift each night for 8 days. The holiday represents light in the midst of darkness for many Jewish people. You might be familiar with the stories of Irish, Welsh, Germans, Italians, and African Americans venturing to Appalachia in search of work or a better life. In light of Hanukkah, today on our show we'll be hearing from Jewish Appalachians, a group that's not really talked about a whole lot. Our journey to find these folks started with a message from a new listener. About a month ago, I got a message on Facebook from Kirsten Kennedy. She wondered if we'd ever done an episode about Jewish Appalachians. She wrote, "I thought you may be able to let people know that we are here as well. We are small, but we are here." Smiley face emoji.
Kind of sad, I guess, because I feel like we used to be such a large community.
That's Kirsten Kennedy. We invited her to the studio to tell us more about her Jewish community. She lives in South Charleston and grew up in St. Albans, West Virginia.
My mother always said we were Baptist, but we never went to church or anything like that. Like, I think I've been in a church maybe 5 times in my entire life. And so we weren't really religious.
When she got older, she felt the need to connect with her spirituality. Kirsten converted to Judaism about 2 years ago and regularly attends the synagogue in Charleston.
I have met loads of wonderful, wonderful people at the synagogue, and I love them all dearly. But unfortunately, I think all but 3 of them have been old enough to be a parent or a grandparent to me.
She's thought about moving away, not just to find a larger Jewish community, but for economic reasons as well.
It is actually kind of scary. Like, I worry because a lot of people my age are moving away for, like, school or, you know, jobs. And because of that, the communities are getting smaller. And the Jews that are still here that are my age, some of them are, I guess, falling away from religion in general. And so they don't come to the synagogue other than, like, high holidays. Not that that's bad, per se, but it's not exactly helping either. And it's kind of depressing because if we don't help keep things going, it's not going to be here.
Thanks to Kirsten's inspiration, today on Inside Appalachia, we're featuring stories from an award-winning series produced by West Virginia Public Broadcasting titled Story of the Jews in 2014, which highlights the struggles that many Jewish congregations are going through because so many young Jewish people are leaving Appalachia. Jews now only make up 0.1% of West Virginia's population. In 1899, there was about 6,000 Jews in the state. But by 2014, that number had dwindled to a little more than 2,300, according to the Jewish Virtual Library. That's a decline by two-thirds, while the rest of the country's Jewish population has quintupled. You see, when the West Virginia coal industry was established in the late 1800s and throughout several booming decades of the 20th century, Jewish people came to West Virginia and established businesses that supported the coal-based economy. But when the coal industry suffered decline in the late 1950s and 60s, many Jewish families, along with many of their Gentile neighbors, left the state for economic opportunities in other states and other parts of the country. The Jews who remain say sometimes they find cultural challenges in small Appalachian communities. It can be tough to find kosher foods or other Jews to date or marry or Jewish education for their children. And it can be tough to find a synagogue. Some have closed as the Jewish population has dwindled, and some struggle to bring in young members. Rabbi Victor Yurecki has led the congregation at the Benah Jacob Synagogue in Charleston, West Virginia, for almost 30 years now. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Beth Voorhees talked with Rabbi Yurecki recently and asked him how the synagogue is doing.
Economically very stable. The numbers are still a challenge. It's a challenge everywhere. We're holding our own, but you don't see a lot of young people in coming to West Virginia, and there, as a result of the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. The Jewish community, not just in West Virginia, but throughout the country, is the oldest minority population. So that feeds into that difficulty, and then you add to the West Virginia narrative. That makes it very a challenge. Mm-hmm. The excitement is we're finding more and more people, both Jews who are rediscovering their faith at a later age, and we're also finding people that are not necessarily becoming Jewish, but feel the interconnectedness of the Jewish faith with their own traditions. And to the great credit of my synagogue, they've allowed me to kind of open up the doors of the synagogue. For example, this yesterday morning we had our Bible class, our Torah class. Our Torah class often has just as many people not of the Jewish faith and of the Jewish faith. So when you come and listen to the Torah class, it's exciting. It would not have been that way if we just kept ourselves very insular.
What is the impact of consolidations and closures of other synagogues throughout West Virginia?
We have two in Charleston. We have one in Huntington. There recently, the one in Parkersburg just closed. There is a congregation in Beckley. There is one in Bluefield. It's struggling. It's trying the best it can to survive. There is a congregation in Morgantown and a congregation in Wheeling. And each of them face their own unique challenges. Some of them are a little bit more financially secure, so they can survive despite the numbers. Some of them are just hanging on, but they don't have the lay leadership that have the ability to maintain the traditions that are necessary. And it's difficult for them to hire a rabbi, a full-time rabbi. So they make do with a student rabbi that can only come maybe once a month. So I'm hoping in the next, maybe not 30 years, but the next 15, 20 years, that we can continue to have classes. My dream one day is, and I don't know if it's possible because our clergy are so, there's so many things that our clergy have to do, but I would love to have weekly clergy get-togethers, public forums where we each take our own faith traditions or more so our sacred texts and share with each other. A minister will take a section from the gospel, and here's an imam, a rabbi, a Unitarian minister, each of them, how do you look at this text? What does this text speak to you? And then the following week, the imam brings the Quran. We all can look at that. I can bring the Torah one week. And in a public setting, so other people can understand that we share so much, we take so much from each other, and we learn so much from each other.
Rabbi Yurecki was the 2011 recipient of the Living the Dream Award for his work on interfaith relations and the 2014 West Virginia Civil Rights Award recipient. Oh, and by the way, we hear that he also has a really nice comic book collection. Rabbi Yurecki mentioned that some temples in West Virginia can't afford a full-time rabbi, so student rabbis visit monthly to host services. Temple Beth El in Beckley is one of those struggling synagogues. Reporter Suzanne Higgins talked with members to find out how they're hoping to adapt to these new challenges.
It's a small temple like a little small country church. We've gotten members from out of town that have come here from a bigger community, and they maybe stayed here 10 or 15 years. And one thing about it, every one of them tells me, Or even somebody that just walks through the door for the first time, they'll say, you know, I feel as close to God here as I've ever felt in my life.
Tom Sofer was once a teenager helping the rabbi at Temple Beth El in Beckley with maintenance and yard work. Decades later, he's president of Temple Beth El and still doing that maintenance and yard work. He tells us the small cinder block building, updated years later with a stucco exterior, was built in 1935.
At that time, there was a large group of Jewish people in Beckley, a lot of merchants, and they were conducting services like in people's homes. And they were also using a few churches around the area. And then they said, you know, maybe we need to put a temple together.
The town of Beckley donated the land for the construction of the building. Throughout the 20th century and into the new millennium, Judaism has clearly been a minority religion in the southern coal fields, and those numbers continue to decline. At its peak in the 1960s, there were 60 Jewish families in Beckley alone that were active congregants. Sofer estimates the temple now has about 30 families, and those are drawn from throughout the region.
Back in the 90s, when my kids were involved in Temple Beth El, there was a nice group of kids and parents that were very active in the temple, and we had Hanukkah parties and the high holidays. The temple was full of laughter and, you know, little footsteps running up and down the aisles and those type of things. And now, in 2014, the kids have all grown up and they've gone their way. And not all of the parents come to temple on a regular basis, so...
Does that worry you?
Yes, it's concerning. But, you know, there is a core group of Jewish people in the community, and they really, really want it to work.
My name is Scott Gelman. I am the student rabbi at Temple Beth El in Beckley, and they are so excited to have me, and I am so excited to be here with them.
Scott Gelman is a second-year student at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati. He drives from Ohio once a month to lead this congregation in Sabbath services, education classes, and special events. Because membership has declined, Temple Beth El hasn't been able to afford a full-time rabbi since its last and beloved rabbi, Isidore Wien, died in 2000.
So this program really enables Judaism to continue thriving in small communities. I've had experience leading services in other realms, but to be the spiritual leader of this congregation, of this incredible community, is such an honor.
Gelman explains Temple Beth El is a Reformed synagogue, a denomination of Judaism that actively reaches out to be part of the greater community.
Our ties with the Jewish community and the greater community is really shown here on the Bima, which is the stage. We have an Israeli flag, and on the other side, we have an American flag, showing that we are truly have one foot in each community.
Also on the Bima, or the stage, is the menorah, a seven-branch candelabra replicating what the Bible says was used in the Temple of Jerusalem. Also in this area, the lighted memorial boards, names of members of the synagogue who have passed away.
And actually, the synagogue does a very interesting thing that I have not seen in other synagogues. They have names of important people in the world who they feel have had an impact on the world, weren't necessarily part of the community here, but we have names like John F. Kennedy and actually Anwar Sadat as well.
And in the center, the Ark, representing the Ark of the Covenant, which the Israelites built in the desert when Moses came down with the tablets.
And so inside of the Ark, this community has two Torahs. Judaism today is not Torah law, but is extrapolations, and it is the original blueprint, but is not the blueprint for our living nowadays.
On this cold winter's evening, with the snow steadily falling, about 15 members of Temple Beth El listen to Rabbi Gelman link a recent Jewish holiday that celebrates nature with what he called the environmental tragedy of the chemical spill in the Elk River, and then ultimately with the temple's concern about its future.
Last week, we celebrated the holiday of Tu B'Shvat, and Tu B'Shvat specifically celebrates the New Year of Trees.
So this new year of trees helps us to think about the environment and its ebbs and flows, but it is still easy to take for granted what we have, that is, until it's gone. We all learned how to not take the life source that comes out of the tap for granted. This building and its community are the lifeline of the Jewish community in Beckley. We must remember that this building stands and this community thrives because of those who never took it for granted.
The congregation celebrated this evening the birthday of 90-year-old Irene Fink, a member of one of the founding families of the temple.
My name is Irene Besso Fink. I came to Beckley in 1943. My husband, Sidney Fink, family of L.J. Fink. We had the Hub and Vogue, wonderful family store uptown, and a woman's specialty shop. It just has been a wonderful community, and there's no place like Beckley, West Virginia.
That's lovely. Let me ask you, what has Temple Beth-El meant to you personally? Can you talk about what this building and everything that it stands for?
Anything that is good, progressive, honest, which is very difficult to come by, continuously growing. What we learned very, very young, what the good Lord taught us. Health, nature, beauty, honesty.
I'm Kenneth Fink. I'm actually a resident of Huntington, and I came up today to both because of the traditions in the temple and to honor my mom's birthday. Even though I'm from Huntington, I have kept in touch with what goes on here, and I was born and raised here and was bar mitzvahed here, in fact, many years ago. So I have fond memories standing in the sanctuary and see a lot of names on the memorial board that I knew. Members of this community have always been active in public issues and the growth of Beckley, and certainly the congregation has diminished in numbers. As you probably know, many synagogues over West Virginia in the recent years have closed and consolidated. But I think people here have a sense of hope that somehow they'll find a will and a way, and hopefully people will return or people will gravitate here. They make a great effort to try to keep the place going, and I'm proud of them. That's why I came tonight.
So this small congregation moves forward with the doors of the temple wide open. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Beckley.
Many Jewish families remember finding a welcoming community when they came to Appalachia. But life for Jewish people hasn't been without discrimination here in West Virginia. In 1958, a lawyer named Stanley Deutsch became the first Jewish person to be elected to the state legislature. His granddaughter is incidentally our colleague here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Radio host Joni Deutsch remembers hearing stories of her grandfather's struggle to own property in Kanawha County.
So my grandfather came back from World War II, and he came back to his hometown of Charleston, West Virginia, where he had a family and where he had a great legal practice. And there came a time when he wanted to move out of his home in downtown Charleston on Virginia Street to a different part of Charleston, South Hills. So he went to South Hills, he found a property, he thought it'd be great, and he's wanting to purchase it. But the problem was there was a restricted covenant on the property, wherein if you're Catholic or Black or Jewish, you wouldn't be able to purchase it. So he called on his friend, who's a corporal in the war, served with him, to purchase the land, since the corporal wasn't Catholic or Black or Jewish. And the corporal would then take the property and sell it to my grandfather. Now, technically, that wasn't legal because you can't even allow someone who's not Catholic, Black, or Jewish to purchase the property for someone who's Catholic, Black, or Jewish. But they did it anyways. My family moved up there, and no one told them to leave or get out. They just lived. And it's nice now because that road that they lived on is just a couple streets down from where I currently live in Charleston. So whenever I drive to and from work, to the radio station, to my house, I look at the road, and I think of my grandfather and how great he is.
That was Joni Deutsch remembering her grandfather, the late Stanley Deutsch, the first Jewish person in West Virginia to be elected to the state legislature. And Deutsch's cousin, Delegate Mike Pushkin, is currently the only Jewish person serving in the state legislature. Pushkin is also a musician. Throughout West Virginia's history, only a half dozen Jewish people have served in the state government. But I wonder if any of them were in a band before Mike Pushkin. Here he is playing a song he wrote called Love Keeps the Lights On. Say a little prayer for better weather.
darkest sky soon turned to blue. Take a little look outside of yourself and let that light shine out on you. Love keeps the lights on. Love keeps the lights on. With a little bit of love, a whole lot of help.
When we come back, we'll hear from two Holocaust survivors who found refuge in Appalachia. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Hine ma tovu mandayim, shevet achim gam yachad. Hine ma tov, shevet achim gam yachad. Hine ma tov, shevet achim gam yachad. Hine ma tovu mandayim.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing about ongoing struggles of Jewish communities in Appalachia determined to preserve the traditions of their religion. About 80 years ago, the Jewish people were determined to preserve their lives after being persecuted, tortured, and executed. We're going to hear stories of people who survived the Holocaust, an atrocity on a scale the world had never known before. One that continues to haunt us to this day. First, we'll hear from Daniel Kareth, who came to West Virginia as a young man and lived to be 95 years of age, passing away about a year ago. Today, we remember Mr. Kareth as he wanted us to remember the lessons of the Holocaust. Suzanne Higgins visited Kareth at his Bluefield home in 2011.
My name is Tom Keretz.
It's so nice to
meet
you.
Nice meeting you.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it?
Isn't it?
What kind of flowers do you have?
African violets.
African violets? Well, you know, those are very temperamental. You must do very well with them.
The place is, they like the place.
Oh, they like the sun right
here. They like the sun, see here.
Daniel Kareth is a retired librarian who worked several decades for Concord University. He walks about with effort, offering a fresh cup of coffee in his cozy kitchen in Bluefield. As National Holocaust Day of Remembrance approaches, the 92-year-old survivor says years on the run and in prison were life-defining.
It lives with me. It should I say, of course, everything becomes unimportant compared with that experience, especially that none of my family came back. So uncles, aunts, cousins, my parents, everybody, nobody survived.
Kareth was born into a Jewish family in Vienna, Austria in 1918. His father was an appraiser, his mother a shopkeeper. He had two half-sisters from his father's first marriage. He was 20 years old and working in a textile factory.
It was a normal family under normal conditions. But in 1938, when Germany was occupied by Germany was radically changed from one day to another. Overnight, everything changed in a horrible way. You can't imagine what kinds of Nazis did to make life, long before the Holocaust started, to make life miserable. You couldn't go only in certain hours of the day on the street. You had to wear a star, yellow star that says Jew. You couldn't sit on park benches. You couldn't get to any public places. It is hard to imagine that, for example, Franzl grew up with them. Otto Sudden didn't know me anymore.
When Austria voted to join the Third Reich, Jews desperately tried to leave. But before Karev could, he was arrested and sent to a concentration camp in Austria. When the camp became overcrowded, the Germans released Karev and told him to leave the country within 2 weeks or be rearrested.
So out of desperation, I went at night over the border into Hungary.
Karev says he couldn't find help in Hungary, so he continued to flee to bordering Romania, on foot, with no money and just a few rations.
I can see it still today. To go over the border, I went along a river. And one side of the river is kind of a dam, an earthen dam. And I went on top of this dam, at night, of course. And all of a sudden, I heard steps behind me. So I went off the side and hid over there and was waiting until this person passes me. And there came a dog and started to bark. And I had a sandwich with me and I pieced the dog with the sandwich.
Karev found work for a few months in a mill in Romania, but eventually was deported, ending up in a prison in Palestine.
The human memory is a very strange thing. I remember when I was put in the concentration camp, like a photograph. But I was moved from there to another place, and that is what I absolutely can remember. Totally blank. Perhaps it's good I can't.
Karev remained in Palestine for several years following the war, living and working in a kibbutz. In 1956, he came to America, finished high school, and went on to college, earning degrees in political science and library science. But life as a librarian in New York didn't suit him.
And I found in one of the professional journals an advertisement that said that Concord College is looking for a librarian. And it said in this ad that is healthy, surrounding, and so on, but really means they don't pay very much. And it really was true.
But you ended up here anyway.
They brought me down for an interview, and I fell in love with the place. That was about 40, almost 40 years ago. I think I have a right to say I'm an adopted mountaineer. After 1945, the war ended, not only I, but generally were thought that racism, anti-Semitism, intolerance will disappear. But it went dormant. And now in bad economic times we have now, it revives in full force. We have it around us. So we have to be very careful not to repeat his history. I think it is really forgive but not forget. And this is important to speak about that.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Beckley.
Next, We're going to hear from a Holocaust survivor who spent years educating young West Virginians about the horrors and lessons of the Holocaust. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glennis Board brings us the story of Dr. Edith Levy.
She was born in Vienna, Austria, in 1930. She says her childhood ended 8 years later. She remembers the Jewish holiday where you celebrate finishing reading the Torah.
They dance around with the scrolls, and it's and you try and reach, and you kiss the Torah. And my dad put me on his shoulders, and I leaned forward, and I was able to reach. And I thought I was in heaven, right? And then was Kristallnacht. And then they burned the Torahs on a big bonfire in the middle of a square. And this little kid couldn't understand that. Why can it be such ecstasy in one moment and then just be burned, and you know, and just in a bonfire?
Kristallnacht, a series of coordinated attacks against Jews throughout Nazi Germany and parts of Austria in November of 1938, carried out by paramilitary forces and non-Jewish civilians. At least 91 Jews were killed in the attack, and 30,000 were arrested and incarcerated in concentration camps. Levy says it took some time to be able to understand what was happening.
And then the Nazis took us out of school. I wasn't allowed. And that, I became aware. And also the whispering and the things between the parents. We tried to leave legally. We had passports to, Mom had a brother in Argentina, but everybody was trying to leave Austria because it was mad. Lines were way long. And they closed the consulate just before we were, came to the door. So then Mom had a friend who knew somebody to smuggle us over the border to Belgium. That was a horrible experience.
Levy remembers traveling one moonless night through farm and field, mud and manure, with other families also trying to escape. A rusty nail ripping her father's coat, getting tangled in barbed wire, heightened danger created by a crying baby. These are recollections that spike her memory of escaping Austria. The next several years were full of hiding and fleeing, being caught, dodging bombs, scavenging, illness, ridicule, betrayal, and occasional life-saving kindnesses. They ended up in Brussels, leading a relatively normal life for a time in 1942. That's when she lost her father.
And then Dad got the papers at first. He said to go for forced labor. Mm-hmm. And Mom said go into hiding. And he says, no, if I go, you and the kids will be safe. Because nobody could imagine what Hitler had in mind. No, he figured he didn't mind hard work, so he went. Ultimately, in a way, it did save us. But
Levy never saw her father again. He died sometime later in Auschwitz.
Oh, I tried to find him. I worked my feet off after the war. There were lists of people that had returned. And I was sure my dad was going to be on that list. And sure, the list got shorter and shorter. And then finally you realize he wasn't coming back.
She says at 13, she struggled to find the will to live.
I didn't want to live. After what I'd gone through, what the world, what people were capable of, were good turned to evil, you know. So I lay down on the couch, turned my head against the wall, and then one guy came and said, okay, you don't want to eat, you don't want to live, he says, die. Give Hitler another posthumous victory. Give him another victim. And that's when I said no. That's when I got back on my feet. But I was sick, that was part of it too.
Still, Levy lost faith in humanity and in God.
I couldn't justify it. I couldn't justify a God that would allow that to happen. And if he allowed it to happen, what kind of a cruel God was he?
But her faith wasn't long lost. As a girl, Levy remembers coming across the cover of a magazine, which had pictured a very tall man. His head was next to the moon, and his feet were on the ground in boiling water.
And it said it would take him 3 days for the sensation to reach the brain. And two more for his foot to take out of the water. So that's the simile I took, and said, the good Lord is far away. He's got a lot to do, not just us. And time warp is different. So, you know, we were saved eventually. But what we consider a day is a blink of an eye for the Lord. That's what my childhood little girl decided to make out of it.
Levy eventually married an American and made her way to the United States. She and her family lived for a while in New York City, but she found the culture there unfriendly and alienating. So her husband, Mark, applied to transfer jobs, and they wound up moving to Morgantown. Levy still smiles, thinking back on the first trip to the small West Virginia town. Traveling on the old Route 119, she and her husband landed their car in a ditch at a sharp bend.
Within a matter of seconds, there were two cars and a truck and it stopped. The one car pulled out a chain and pulled us out. And Mark says, there goes a 20. New York mentality, right? He tried to give the guy $20, and you have never seen anyone more offended. That is a neighborly thing to do, he says. We don't take money for that. So that's how we stayed in Morgantown.
Levy was struck by the culture of community living. She says everything from neighbors lending batteries from their cars to sometimes dropping off a brood of children unannounced. She fell in love with Morgantown. What was supposed to be 6 months turned into a home place where she and her husband Mark raised their family. It was several years later when, she says, she heard hate in the hollows. People were trying to deny the Holocaust happened. That's when Edith Levy stood up.
Hey, I know it happened. I was there.
Levy began writing. Her writings appeared in the book Flares of Memory, and she authored a textbook and curriculum entitled The Holocaust in Perspective.
There was nothing in the schools. The history book had one paragraph that mentioned the Holocaust. Who was it that said, if you don't learn from history, you're bound to repeat it?
Levy says one of her proudest accomplishments was finding the courage to stand before the West Virginia legislature to make a case for the creation of the West Virginia Holocaust Education Commission. She was 68 and still terrified of authority. Then Governor Cecil Underwood established the commission by executive order in 1998, and Levy set to work educating middle school students throughout West Virginia.
I figured if I survived the Holocaust and if I survived the illnesses, then the good Lord had a mission for me.
Dr. Levy has since stepped down as chair of the Holocaust Education Commission. She worries that the cause will be lost without a passionate chair.
The thing of it is, as far as I'm concerned, you've got to teach that you can be good. And you don't have to be selfish and say, I don't care.
Dr. Levy is a member of the Hall of Fame of the Human Resources and Education School at West Virginia University and has received the Governor's Lifetime Achievement Award. She dedicated a Holocaust library at the Morgantown Library in honor of her father, J.D. Rector. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Now we'd like to bring you some treats from the Sabbath Supper. Since we've been talking about Jews today, we wanted to share a Jewish-themed Appetite Appalachia. Appetite Appalachia is an occasional segment here on Inside Appalachia, which features restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love getting all over.
People in Charleston, West Virginia recently got a chance to taste some foods that might not have been familiar to them, like noodle kugel and matzo ball soup. Traditional Jewish foods were on the menu at a meal put on by the Charleston chapter of the Women Zionist Organization of America. The Taste of Jewish Cuisine is held every year as a way to raise money for a hospital in Israel. But as Scotty White found out, the meal is more than a fundraiser. It's also a way to share the Jewish connections between food, family, and religion.
with everyone.
The women of the local chapter of Hadassah have been working since July to feed the community during the Taste of Jewish Cuisine held at the Temple Israel in Charleston, West Virginia. Chapter President Lynn Meyer led the group of women on the monumental task of making 600 matzo balls, over 200 pounds of brisket, plus 34 pounds of noodle kugel, vegetables, and desserts.
We made briskets, which is a form of Friday night beef that we grew up with, long cooking. And I think probably if you were to go back to the origins of these things, most people have seen Fiddler on the Roof. They had to get things cooked before the Sabbath started, which is at sundown on Friday night and ends at sundown on Saturday night. And at no time during that time are they allowed to cook or clean or things like that.
Lynn grew up with those traditional meals, and cooking for the community brings back memories.
My mother cooked Friday night dinners, and I would do that now if any of my five kids and their families lived here. They don't. But Steve and I do it ourselves, my husband and I, and I'll always miss those Shabbat dinners, those Sabbath dinners.
For the Taste of Jewish Cuisine, Lynn also baked more than 800 loaves of challah. Challah is a bread that is typically served at the three Sabbath meals, Friday night, Saturday lunch, and Saturday afternoon. It also commemorates the manna that fell from heaven during the 40 years the Israelites wandered the desert after the exodus from Egypt. Challah is made of strands of dough woven together in a braid.
The origin of the braiding was something that I'm absolutely not positive of, but I think we all think that it started that of just intertwining your family lives together, putting the braid together so that your lives are intertwined.
Lives intertwined, much like the Taste of Jewish Cuisine was doing for the community. The room was filled with people from all walks of life, some members of the temple, but many people from the Charleston and the surrounding areas. They are smelled of fresh brisket and kugel.
My name is Isaac Foreman. I live here in Charleston. This is my daughter, Nora. She's one. She's getting her first bite of matzo ball soup. Nora, you want to say hello? No. She likes the matzo ball soup and the kugel. She didn't like the brisket, but it's a little hard for her to chew. Yeah, I think it's great to see everybody here coming out and trying the food and getting a taste of, the Jewish culture. I think it's wonderful because most of the people here are not members of the congregation. They're just people who came to eat some good food.
My name is Linda Taborowski. I'm the past president of Ladies Auxiliary of B'nai Jacob. I love the idea that we're together as a people in all different religions and belief systems, that we can enjoy each other and learn from each other and help each other and whatever we need to do. So it just makes me happy.
Linda says that the Charleston community means a lot to her. Her family's been here for a century. Her grandparents fled from Europe in the 1900s because of the pogroms, which were attacks on the Jewish people.
They came here in the bottom of a boat. Well, my granddad did anyway. It must have been horrible down there. And the bottom of a boat jammed in with the smells, the screams, the crying, and whatever else, no food, was better than what they had in the pogroms. And they taught my brother and me, especially here in Charleston, we look over that capital, they taught us that this is the most magnificent place on earth. No, so to us, Charleston saved us. And if you think how many things were lost over those years, and what could have been, and what we don't have to live here in West Virginia and in the United States, it's a blessed thing. So brisket's part of it. We can make our brisket and read from a Torah. Not at the same time.
And like the brisket that Linda remembers from her childhood, food connects people. The Taste of Jewish Cuisine also helps introduce these food traditions to the community as a whole. It also allows the next generation to sample their first bites of tradition. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Scotty White.
The Taste of Jewish Cuisine is held twice a year, once in the spring and in the fall at Temple Israel in Charleston. This week's show also features Jewish music, and for help with the episode's soundtrack, Inside Appalachia's Roxy Todd went to the Temple Israel to speak with Rabbi Jim Cohn. And she found out that Rabbi Cohn's collection of Jewish music is vast and varied.
Most Jewish ceremonies include singing, prayers, and blessings sung in Hebrew.
This is the beginning of the Torah, the beginning of what Christians call the Old Testament, what Jews call the Hebrew Scriptures, and this is the first few verses of Genesis. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim vet haaretz v'haaretz hayta tohu vavohu v'choshech al pnei tohom v'ruach Elohim rachefet al pnei hamayim v'yomer Elohim yior v'yior v'yar Elohim et haor ki tov v'yavdel Elohim bein haor uvein hachoshech. I think one of the important things about music is that it touches places that words and ideas can't reach. So when you have a text that's considered sacred by a community and you combine that with the areas of our brain and of our mind and of what we metaphorically call our heart that are not reachable simply by the text itself, you have a very powerful combination. And even for the people who can't understand the text itself, non-Hebrew speakers, the melody still reaches some inward place that is important to access. So within the context of a worship service, the music provides a dimension that isn't available through any other means.
But Rabbi Cohn wants people to know that Jewish music is more than the traditional Hebrew chants. He sets out a dozen CDs for me to sample.
I've got my ska and reggae Jewish music that I love to listen to.
Rabbi Cohn says this ska CD by King Django is one of his favorites, but there are others. Music with a swing tempo, music with a Latin American rhythm.
Jewish music is different not only depending upon the culture, the majority culture in which it's found, but also differs from decade to decade and from century to century. So music from Italy in the 17th century that's composed by Jews might be in Hebrew, but it might be sung to the motet form that was characteristic of that environment.
This piece was written in Italy in the 17th century by a Jewish composer named Salomone Rossi. Rabbi Cohn has been collecting this music for decades. He's fascinated by the way musicians are always reinventing what it means to play Jewish music generation after generation.
I love being Jewish and I love music, and to be able to integrate those two things gives a quality to my life that is deeply enriching.
And while the ska music is probably his favorite, there's one very silly one that he just had to play me right before I left.
Constant service, I've seen service all my days. I beat Shalom to Flatbush Avenue in old Brooklyn where I was born and raised.
This is the Soggy Matzo Boys playing their version of Man of Constant Sorrow, Man of Constant Suris. Suris means troubles in Yiddish. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
Can't take this snow and sleet. So we finally moved down to Miami, and now she kvetches about the heat.
Now they're both freezing from the heat.
I've got three kids. You'd think they'd call me. Ah, they've grown.
my son Jacob and my daughter Ruthie.
And you know, hearing some of the Jewish music in Rabbi Cohn's collection got me to thinking, there must be some hip-hop or modern Jewish songs out there. And then I found the Maccabees.
Yeah, Maccabees. Just living in a miracle, candles on my vehicle, eight nights, gonna shine invincible, no longer be divisible, born through the struggle, keep on moving through all this hustle, heads up, heads down through all of the bustle, New York City, wanna flex your muscles, look so down, look so puzzled, gonna run your fire through all the rubble, bound to stumble and fall, but my strength comes not from man at all, bound to stumble and fall, but my strength comes not from man at all.
That's our show today, featuring the ongoing work that Jewish communities in Appalachia are doing to try to keep their traditions alive. Happy Hanukkah. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Ben Townsend, Rabbi Cohn, Josh Barrett, Mike Pushkin, the Maccabees, and Bella Fleck and Abigail Washburn as heard on Mountain Stage. Our Appetite Appalachia music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. Our audio mixing is by Scotty White. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
I asked the man I saw how many Jews in this town. He said to me there used to be a minion around. But one of us passed away and we've been feeling down. Yet now it seems as though another Jew has been found. Won't you stay with us for Shabbos, Minyan Man? I stepped off the bus in Mobile, Alabama. The sun was slowly setting on the bay. 6 o'clock on a summer Friday afternoon. Shabbos was an hour away. I walked around the town wondering what to do. Shabbos is no time to be feeling blue. And then I saw a man who looked the same way too. I was quite relieved to find the fellow Jew.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.